stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 111 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. Coming to you, I hope, for the last time for a while from Catonsville, Maryland, I am Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis, who I assume is in Somerville, Massachusetts.
The thinking man's Cambridge, as they say. Yes, Somerville, Massachusetts. I think I've used that joke before.
Yeah, I've definitely used the I assume Somerville before, but that's okay. Yeah. People, you know, not everyone listens to every single one of these episodes. Let's not flatter ourselves.
Yeah, and we're like over 200 hours of content. So, I mean, if you hung out with me for 200 hours in real life, you would definitely get some of the same comments over and over again.
Confirmed.
So it's, yeah. All right. So, so you've finished a bit of a milestone. Yes, you have something to announce to our listeners.
I do. Some exciting news for listeners and readers as well. Volume 3 of The Thinking Poker Diaries is now available. You can pick that up at knitcast.com or from the Amazon Kindle store. And The Thinking Poker Diaries, for those who don't know, are a series of ebooks, sort of a mix of trip reports and strategy essays from all of the WSOP main events I've played. So I'm working my way forwards. 2006, 2007 have been out for a couple months now, and 2008 has just been published. And this is a big one. 2008 was the best main event of my career. Spoiler alert, for those who are really concerned about these things. I ended up finishing 35th and won nearly $200,000, and this book tells that story. So you'll get the strategy behind all of the important pots that led to that victory, and also get to meet the colorful and sometimes irritating characters I encountered along the way. That is available for $9.99 at knitcast.com or the Kindle store. And for those who have read the first two books, you should know this one is longer than both of them put together, because it was the deepest run that I've had. There was a lot to write and talk about, and it's covering 6 days of some pretty intense tournament poker. So I hope that you will pick that up, enjoy it, and if you do pick it up, please let me know. You know, reviews on Amazon are great. If you just want to email me, write into podcast@thinkingpoker.net. You can reach us that way, and I'm very curious to hear what you all think of this series. So as I mentioned, I'm hoping that this is going to be my last week stuck in Catonsville. I've had a couple of family things come up, and one of them does actually overlap a little bit with podcast news, which was that our guest on episode 21 of the podcast was my grandmother. She was on the show talking about her brother, who was really a colorful character in quite a few ways. I hope you'll listen to the episode, so I won't spoil too much about it, but he was a 400-pound cross-dressing stand-up comedian, and he also loved gambling, so that was the excuse for putting it on the show. But really, I kind of just wanted an excuse to record a conversation with my grandmother, because I knew that she was not going to be around forever, and sadly, she has passed away. So those of you, some of you may remember her from that episode. Those of you who haven't listened, I encourage you to listen to episode 21 of the podcast. I intend to go back and listen to it, but I haven't been able to bring myself to do that yet. But that's one of a couple things that has kind of kept me stuck on the East Coast. And it's also tying up a lot of my time right now. So we're sort of cramming this, or I anyway, am kind of cramming this episode in. It is going to be just Nate and myself talking strategy. That's probably good news to some of you. Apologies to those of you who really enjoy the interviews, but I think there's been some pretty interesting ones recently. So if you missed last week's conversation with the Computer Poker Research Group, the ones who solved Heads Up Limit Hold'em, I think that's well worth a listen. Or if you want to go back a little bit further, we also had an interview recently with David Einhorn that I think you'll probably find pretty interesting as well. So if you want interviews, a couple of good ones on the show recently, and if you want strategy, stay tuned.
Well, condolences to you, condolences to your family. Grandmother gave a delightful interview. Doubtless reflects her personality, and I'm sure I'm joining a lot of people who will offer their condolences.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Yeah, looking forward to getting back to San Francisco.
Yeah, I kind of just want life to get back to normal, but yeah. Hopefully that will be the case soon.
Yeah, if you need, for the plane ride, if you need hours and hours of Gareth and I talking about a final table that's happening in real time. You know where to get that.
Oh, yes. I haven't watched that yet, but where do I get that?
I think there's a link somewhere. It's like, yeah. Actually, I think you can get it on your own blog. I think if you go to the Nate and Gareth, the YouTube link where you could watch it in real time, I believe archives it. And if it didn't, then you can go to the Full Tilt blog, which I think is blog.fulltilt.com. But if you Google Full Tilt blog, you'll get there, and you can just click play from there. And now that I think about it, if you can click play and embed it in a blog, probably that's just a YouTube link.
Yeah, and I'll drop a link in the show notes as well. But I am looking forward to watching this. As I think I've mentioned on air before, I know I mentioned on the blog, you guys did a great job with your commentary on the 25 game and the 10 game was the other one that you did?
Yeah, 10 game.
You guys really did a great job with your commentary on that. I'm curious to listen to Gareth carry you through a conversation about No Limit Hold'em. I think you guys make a really great team, and I do encourage people to go and check this out. As I said, I'll put a link in my show notes, so you can probably find it on the Full Tilt Poker blog. And Gareth and Nate talking through a final table of the mini F-tops, I think that's a pretty exciting strategy.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the kind words. It really is something to have the roles reversed, because Gareth is walking me through it, and I'm also sort of playing a quasi-Socratic role where, like, I take the things he says and I try to, build on them or make them or repeat them, maybe for an audience that'll have players of all experience and all skill level. And sometimes Gareth won't know when I'm done talking or not, so I just sort of end the play-by-play portion with some random question about the hand for Gareth. Have you read Infinite Jest?
Yes.
So do you remember that portion? So for listeners who haven't read the book, it takes place at a tennis academy, and one of the students is a minor character, is an aspiring announcer, and his thing is finding synonyms for won and lost, because he has to announce the tennis scores and you have to announce like all the wins and losses. Anyway, one thing I learned is that there are really only so many ways to say opens for a min raise. Just not that many. In online poker, you get a lot of hands every hour, and if everybody's min raising, boy. At some point you just have to say what it is, so you just have to say raise over and over again. But one thing to learn.
If you're not already a member of Tournament Poker Edge, now is a great time to sign up. I've got a new series appearing there that's in addition to dozens of hours of my training material already available, plus hundreds of hours from other instructors. And this new series that's going up is a hand-for-hand review from a huge WCOOP event. It was a Sunday warm-up tournament, thousands of entrants, and I made it pretty deep. So this is a great chance to see how I navigated and learn how you can navigate a huge field full of some of the best and worst players on the internet. You'll find all of that and much, much more at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Our first hand today comes from Mike in New Jersey. The hand is played on 888, a site that I, Nate, cannot read the name of without thinking of Dan Harrington's hat or shirt in the 2003 main event. This is a New Jersey site. It's the second hand Mike has played at this 50-cent, $1 No Limit Hold'em table with 100 big blind effective stacks. An unknown villain raises to $3 from the cutoff. The button folds, and hero 3-bets to $10 from the small blind with ace-queen of clubs. The big blind folds, and the villain calls. I endorse 3-betting with ace-queen suited from the small blind and in an online game against an open from the cutoff. What do you think, Andrew?
As much as I hate the word standard, this is a pretty good time to use it. I think there's not a lot of reason to do anything other. I mean, certainly without a read on your opponent, I don't think there's much reason to do anything differently from this. I can imagine some opponents against whom calling might be better. It would take a hell of a lot to make me just open fold this. I think 3-betting should certainly be your default here. You've got a very strong hand, definitely figures to be ahead of a random cutoff opener's range. You're happy to take it down preflop if that's what happens. If he calls, you can still expect to be ahead. You don't want to give the big blind a good price to proceed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think we can sit around all day talking about edge cases when you might when you might just call or fold. I would say that the most common reason to do anything other than 3-bet would be if the big blind is very poor after the flop and will call basically anything for the $3 and will play very tight for the $10. Like, again, there are many sort of hypothetical things that you can think of to change the correct play. The one that actually comes up sometimes for me is like, is like I'm playing 2-5 at Foxwoods and the big blind will come along with, you know, Jack 6 offsuit and then play top pair forever, or will stack off with any flush for 200 big blinds, but will fold a lot if I 3-bet. Like that's the one where I think, okay, that's the case that actually happens sometimes. Does that make sense to you?
It does, but let's not give people too many excuses to call here. This should be a 3-bet.
No, no. Rare thing. Very rare. Very rare. So the flop is 8-7-7 2-tone. So there's one club. So the 3-better, Mike from New Jersey here, flops a backdoor flush draw and 2 overcards. Pretty good flop. Mike bets $12.50 into $20 after rake, and the other guy calls. So what do you think of the flop bet?
I like it. And let me actually read Mike's comment here, because I kind of want to make my comments in response to his. So Mike's comments on the hand, he says, I'm curious to hear some thoughts on what types of boards you would be inclined to check fold after 3-betting at a position. I don't expect him to call with many hands I'm ahead of, and I think most of his small pocket pairs would at least call the flop bet. So I think, you know, Mike's kind of saying, well, I don't think he's going to call with worse. I don't think he's going to fold better. And I do often say that those are the two, many people say those are the two main reasons to bet. Mike, however, goes on to say, and I think this is important, he says, part of my reason for betting the flop, despite these thoughts, was that there would likely be a fair bit of good turn barreling cards. Any club, king, or jack can likely be profitable to bet, and the queen or ace will give me the best hand a large percentage of the time. By checking here, I would be very lost if he bet. Perhaps not a good enough reason to check, and I'm trying to get out of the, if I 3-bet pre-flop, I have to bet the flop, thinking without having more justification. I think that that's not the worst default mindset to be in. I mean, there's the old Ed Miller, like, or not old, but there's the Ed Miller, you know, you bet 70% of the time if you were the aggressor on the previous street. So I think it is okay to default to betting. You know, if you're not sure what to do and you were the aggressor on the previous street, you should probably just bet again. I think that's an okay rule of thumb. It's definitely good to kind of interrogate these sorts of situations and be considering alternatives. And I'll say to you, Mike, that I thought the way you were kind of thinking through here in general, I mean, you're right that you're going to have a lot of good barreling opportunities, and that's definitely a big part of the reason why you should bet the flop. I mean, I think one of the reasons to bet the flop, like, this is a flop that does not change the pre-flop situation terribly much. Your opponent is probably a little bit more likely, well, definitely a little bit more likely to hold, you know, a 7 than you are, and some of the other suited connectors he calls with, their equity has improved against you a bit because they've, you know, picked up suited connectors and still have, or they've picked up straight draws and they still have live cards. But, you know, I think for the most part, like, we assumed we were ahead of his preflop range. We thought we'd be ahead even against his calling range. And I don't think that this flop changes terribly much. I think we still have a pretty strong hand here. You know, now the fact that we didn't hit an ace or a queen means this hand is a little weaker relative to our range than it was pre-flop, and, you know, the pocket pairs in our range have gone up in value a bit. But if we're going to bet all those pocket pairs, and I think we do want to bet all of our pocket pairs, you know, all the way up to aces on this board, then we need some non-pocket pair hands to bet with as well. And I think this is a very good candidate. Even if you are called by your opponent's pocket pairs, you've got 2 overcards, you've got the backdoor flush draw, as you say, you've got good barreling opportunities. So this is a, you know, it's a very nice bluffing hand on the flop. And I kind of think if you bet, you know, as you do, I think your sizing is very good here. If you bet somewhere in the neighborhood of half of the pot, your opponent really only has 2 choices. He can fold a lot to your bet, which is sort of a, you know, a fine outcome for you, even if he folds a hand like King Jack. Like, that's a pretty live hand against you. Even if you are technically ahead of it, you don't really mind just having him fold that hand right now. He doesn't have, you know, you don't have much in the way of implied odds against those. And if you're planning on barreling a King or Jack, you might even have some slight reverse implied odds against that hand. So you don't mind him folding some of those hands that are slightly behind you. And, you know, he only has 2 choices. He either folds a lot, including, you know, some hands like that, or he calls with some hands that are worse than yours. And that might be hands that are tricky to play against, like diamond draws or 10-9, but I mean, ultimately, there is, I think, a little bit of value in making this bet. There's either protection value from making him fold equity, or there's value in the sense that you'll get called by worse, and then you're just going to have to play poker on future streets. But I think that you have a pretty good plan for how to do that.
I like it. That all makes sense.
Sorry, did I steal everything you were going to say?
Yeah, then some. I learned something. That was very instructive. Good. So the turn is a queen. It's the queen of hearts. The board is 8-7 queen. The turn is not a flush card. So Mike checks, and the other person bets 24 into 43, leaving 64 behind. And Mike shoves. So he shoves the turn, and Mike's thoughts are, the turn is obviously a great card for me and a good card for my range as well. In a vacuum, I think the best play is to bet again. The reason behind that being, I just want to be able to bet this card as a bluff, and if that's the case, I can't just be checking every time I have one pair in the spot, which is going to be fairly often. On the other hand, I don't know how many worse hands are calling my shove. Would I really play an ace-x of diamonds, so a nut flush draw hand like this? Probably not. Does he know that? Probably not. I'd be more inclined to just bet large on the turn with a big draw. Against a bad player, I think it's an okay shove, as they'll talk themselves into calling incorrectly with a flush draw some percentage of the time, and perhaps even convince themselves that my shove looks like a draw and call with any pair. If that's true, how often are they betting those hands on the turn when I check? Doesn't seem to me like they'd be bet calling off with fives or even nines through jacks with great regularity, which seemingly makes the shove worse. After all that, do you think check calling might be best on the turn once we decided to not bet? If so, what would be your plan on diamond rivers? Does the SPR being less than one on the river mean you are just calling off on any river? Okay, good questions. I like that Mike is thinking carefully, and I like the content of a lot of these thoughts. I think this is going well.
Yeah, I think you're asking the right questions, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would bet this turn a lot of the time. I'm going to get to this turn with plenty of vulnerable hands. So either whiffed hands or hands that are vulnerable to a shove. So I would like to beef up my betting range a little bit. And I think ace queen is not a bad hand to put in my betting range. So, I think I would default to betting here a lot. I think it's going to be easy for him to talk himself into calling with a hand like nines. I guess he might have four bet that before the flop. If he made a loose call before the flop and has an eight, then I think he might have a hard time folding that. I think, ace jack high is going to give you a hero call sometimes. I think flush draws will shove over you sometimes. I think a lot of good things can happen. I also think that other hands are going to play pot control here sometimes, and some of the ones that will bet as a bluff if you check will also play with you as a bluff somehow if you bet, at least sometimes. So I like what Mike says. I think he's thinking about this accurately, but from a range point of view, I see at least some reasons to put ace queen in a default betting range. What do you think of that?
Let me ask you another question, which is, what would you want to do here if you had ace jack of diamonds?
I would want to bet.
And call a shove, fold to a shove?
Yeah. I guess check raising is good. Like, I would like to have a check raise. Yeah, tough. Bet.
See, this is kind of my thinking. The stacks are sort of awkward. So I would like betting a lot if we could either, just go all in without it being like a shove. Here is basically twice the pot, probably a little more than twice the pot, just about twice the pot actually. So I would like betting if it was more, we're maybe betting 125% a pot, something like that, to just shove, or if there was a lot of money behind where we could bet and still leave and still have a fair amount of money behind where opponent is not necessarily going to shove. I sort of feel like with these stack sizes, you're going to get people, a lot of people feel like, and not wrongly, that they should just sort of make a decision on the turn and either shove or fold with a lot of their range. And so that makes it kind of tricky for you to play hands like ace jack suited, where they're good semi-bluffing hands, but at the same time, you really want to be making the last bet with those. And if you bet a kind of normal amount, like Mike does here, somewhere in the neighborhood of half the pot, then you kind of set your opponent up to jam on you. And if you decide, well, I'm going to bet some huge amount, like I'm going to bet 2x the pot, you know, Mike says, I would just bet big with those hands. Like, how big are we talking? Are you just potting it with a flush draw? And even then, your opponent, you know, still can raise and you're getting like 3-1 on a call, which I guess you just call off at that point, but it's not like a fantastic situation. I mean, either, whether you pot it or whether you shove, you're effectively committing like twice the pot with your bet, which that can be a kind of a tricky thing to balance. So, you know, if I guess I would be inclined to say if we're not making assumptions about how our opponent is going to play, which Mike kind of hedges on that, but he doesn't really give us many assumptions about what his opponent will actually do. So if we're trying to approach this in a somewhat balanced way, I guess you sort of have three options. You can just have a shoving range, which consists of like big draws and, you know, king, queen plus or something like that, and just shove 2x pot and do that within a balanced way. You could try to have two ranges, like a betting range, you know, some of which folds to a shove, some of which calls a shove, and also a check raising range. And the problem there is just whether you have enough strong hands to balance two different ranges. And you might, I know, like I'm not necessarily ruling that out. Or the third would be to just check this flop, or sorry, just check this turn a lot, and not do a lot of barreling, and mostly just have like a check folding range and a check shoving range. I think that last strategy is most desirable against more aggressive players. So the more that you think somebody might float and then bet the turn with like 10-9 or two diamonds, it's really enticing to be able to check shove in those cases with a hand like ace-queen. It's really nice to induce another bet from those hands and then either blow them off their equity or force them to call off. Now, everything that we said about why it might be awkward for hero to bet with a draw also applies to the villain. And so some people might, again, not necessarily incorrectly, choose to check back on the turn with some of their draws. And that's a pretty big disaster for you. So especially if you have an idea that your opponent's going to bet a lot when checked to, which I know that, you know, Mike does not have much of a read on this player, that would make me more inclined to go for the check raise. I think here, I mean, if we decide to just throw balance to the wind, I do like betting with this hand more than I like checking with it, and you give some good reasons for that, Nate. I mean, I think that even if we're not betting, like even if we agree that draws are going to put us in a dicey spot, and we might try to check raise some of our bigger draws, and when we do have a big draw, we don't really mind if it checks through. You know, that's not as much of a problem as when we have queen X. So even if we only check raise the big draws, yeah, that's not actually that easy of a thing to exploit. And I think that, you know, betting with ace queen is a lot better than giving your opponent a chance to take a free card with it. And I think that it can be balanced by betting some lower equity hands. So although we don't want to bet fold a hand like ace jack of diamonds, we don't mind bet folding a hand like ace king offsuit or king jack offsuit or some other hands that you might have three bet, or maybe even small pocket pairs, you know, pocket twos or something, some other hands that you might have three bet that you can kind of use as your bet folding range rather than having to use your big draws that way.
Yep. I like all that. The one sort of slight correction I would make that I know you understand is that you don't necessarily need tons of hands to balance out two different ranges, like aggressive actions from two different ranges. You could just have a narrow check raising range and then put a few strong hands enough to balance it out in that range. So it's not always a matter of the number of combinations you have. It can be harder to keep straight in your head. It can be harder to actually play consistently over 100,000 hands, but like you really could just have narrow ranges. So there are examples in mathematics of poker. Of course, these are not card poker games. These are 0-1 poker games where you're actually betting a different amount with every value hand, but it's okay because you also have like the right sort of the right number of bluffs. I mean, these are all differentials. These are all infinitesimally small, but like, yeah, you can have infinitely many betting ranges, and that's okay. So, I don't think that having fewer good hands entails that you can be, you know, have fewer ways to put money in the pot from a game theory point of view on that street.
I think you're right about that. And I kind of came around to that point too as I was talking, because I think that even if you only check shove big draws, like that still puts your opponent, I mean, ace jack of diamonds isn't necessarily a bluff, like because you could be up against 10-9 or two lower diamonds. I mean, it's kind of like, it's not exactly a bluff or a value hand. So I think even if your range only consists of big draws when you check shove the turn, even that I think is not that much of a disaster. And if you also throw in some full houses or something.
Or like just aces with the ace of spades in them, like I mean, that would be hard to play against, I think. Like a range that was, or like, I mean, what if your range was just maybe half your aces, half your kings, all your big draws, and there shouldn't be that many because a lot of them you're not three betting before the flop, then a few like pure bluffs to, well no, then you aren't going to check raise all in, so really just that, just your big draws and then a few made hands for whatever value you need. If anything, you might need to put some weaker hands in there. Like the challenge might be throwing a few hands with blockers into that range, right?
So, yeah.
So that's, nothing you didn't say, but I just wanted to emphasize that.
That's good. The last thing he asked was about, you know, once you check, is shoving better than calling? I think the answer there is a pretty definitive yes.
Yeah.
I think that once you call, I mean, some opponents will just give up and not bluff the river anymore, which is pretty bad for you because then they're just free rolling to improve on the river. But even if they will, like, the only reason you would call there is if you have some exploitable read on your opponent, like that specifically that he'll just bluff the river way too much. And that's kind of tricky here because you don't even know which rivers are, I mean, you know which rivers are bad for you, but he also knows. So like when he has 9-10, he can bluff diamonds. When you have diamonds, you can bluff a jack or a six. And it's kind of tricky for you to, I just think there's a lot of rivers where you're going to have tough decisions. Even if you know what your opponent's range is, there's not going to be real profitable decisions for you. So I think having gotten this far, knowing that you're not going to fold the river, it's better for you to get it in now rather than, you know, wait and let your opponent have the information about whether or not a draw hits and then be forced to guess, you know, whether or not he's bluffing.
Agreed.
So yeah, very well played hand, I think, and also very impressed with your thoughts on here. As I said, I think you asked a lot of the right questions, and hopefully that generated some good discussion for everyone else as well. But certainly, I hope it helped you, Mike. Thanks for writing.
Yeah, you want to lead us through our next hand here, Andrew?
Yeah, and this next one is coming from one of my students, and the hand was not explicitly submitted for consideration on the podcast, so I'm just going to say anonymous because the student actually has a unique enough name that I wouldn't be surprised if someone was like, oh, hey, I know someone who plays poker who's named X.
Is it Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Yeah, Joseph, if you're out there, please send us a hand. We would...
It's a pretty unique name.
So our hero is playing in a 2-5 no limit game. Let's assume $500 effective stacks. He is in the big blind holding 6-5 suited, and there was an open to $15 from middle position. Two people call. So middle position opens $15, two people call. Hero is in the big blind with 6-5 suited. Let's even just pause here. What's your play in it?
I would call. I think you're getting the right price to call. You have a suited connector. It's a live 2-5 game. I think folding is not in the question. And I have other hands I would like to re-raise with. I think if I were to re-raise, it would be A, because the 6-high drawing hands are going to be dominated more often after the flop. You're going to be flush under flush sometimes. And so if the 15 open is one of those that's always weak and the person would make it 25 with a real hand, and if the two callers were very loose, but it wouldn't be so easy to extract tons of value after the flop, then I might just re-raise and try to take it down and go to the flop with a good drawing hand. If not, so I think that would be my most likely reason to re-raise, but for the most part, I like to be blocking some of the value hands when I re-raise, and 6-5 suited has good value calling. Like, I think this is a really like a winning call. Probably the small suited connectors are some of the most overrated preflop equity hands in poker, but this is a case where $10 more into the spot, it really is, this is a winning call, and I would be happy to keep it there. Yep. Do I pass the test?
You do. I think folding out of the question, and the only thing I would kind of add is that I think that the case that you mentioned is a case where you might consider squeezing is one that I find comes up very frequently in live games with a lot of recreational players, which is that $15 open is just definitively weak. You know, people vary their raise sizes and they raise bigger when they have strong hands. So that's just like that person is folding 90% of the time to a squeeze. And when they don't fold, it's because they're calling looking for a very specific flop. You know, like they have pocket threes or something and they're just calling to set mine, which is going to be a disaster for them against your hand.
remember when we were playing that game at Red Rock and I kept, you know, I was sitting to your right and I kept on three betting all the 15 opens. And then I started to worry that you would just four bet me the next time I re-raised. So yes, I agree with you. I like to attack those.
Yeah, and like likewise the callers. I think there's so many people who will just call with like really wide ranges for 15, but then when you make it like 75, they're like, oh, serious money. I can't play serious money without a serious hand. But if they had a serious hand, they would have raised. So you know, it's just, I think like I can imagine situations where popping it to $75 gets folds like 75% of the time.
Yeah, I mean they don't have $75 hands now, do they?
But yeah, so just don't fold and you're off to a good start. But, you know, I also think that you should just, you know, always be thinking in terms of all of your options. You know, don't necessarily default just because, like, you have a good calling hand. You know, it doesn't necessarily make calling the best play. Mm-hmm. So along comes our flop, which is 10 of spades, 7 of spades, 4 of diamonds. Our hero again holding 6-5 of clubs. So got a low open-ended straight draw, no flush draw going to be possible for our hero, but there are 2 spades on the board, so a flush draw is possible for someone. Our hero ends up leading $40 into the $60 pot, so he just bets right out. Thoughts on that? Do you like checking better?
I think I do. I would want to know how the hand's going to play on later streets. I think this bet gets called a lot, especially if the 15 is a little bit weaker before the flop. I think there are a lot of hands, a lot of draws. I think even a 7 plays with you sometimes. So, you know, if we say that any flush draw, any top pair, any over pair, and like any pair plus draw, or any open-ended straight draw, like if all of those play with you, which is actually a little bit tight for a lot of these games.
I'm thinking like gut shot 7's probably coming along.
Yeah, I mean, that's like really, I mean, Jack 9, a lot of people think that Jack 9 is a very tight fold here.
Yeah, I do not habitually fold Jack 9 to a $40 donk here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, geez, it's, right. Also 6-8 is double gutted. Jeez. Right. Yeah, I just, you're going to get called a lot, so unless you have a great barreling plan, and then I would default to checking. Again, if you check, you can have a good check calling strategy, which is to say, do it when it's right, not when it's wrong. And if you bet, it should be because you have a great barreling strategy, or maybe because you want to inflate the pot and you'll get full stacks from any top pair, but even then, you might be better off checking.
That's the issue, too, is like when you hit, there's a lot of ways that you can hit and still not have a nut hand. So, you know, an 8 makes higher straights possible. A spade, you know, two of your outs are going to be spades, just make flushes possible. So, you know, you really only have 3 outs that are to the nuts. Not that an 8, like, it's not that I'm worried about getting straight over straighted or something, but it's going to make it harder for you to get action because the board is going to be looking pretty scary even if you do have the best hand.
Then on the river, half the deck will either pair the board or make all sorts of straights possible.
Right. So I think like, basically this just isn't that great of a draw. And I also think just as a rule of thumb, the more multi-way the pot is when you're in the worst position, the more you should be inclined to check. Right? In a heads-up pot, there's a lot of incentive for you to bet whether you have a hand that you want to bluff with or a value hand because you know all it takes is one player tapping the table and we're off to the next street and you didn't get to do the thing that you wanted to do. When it's you know 4 or 5 ways, there's a lot of people who could bet and there's more information for you to get. So if you check the preflop raiser bets, someone calls, someone else raises, you can just throw your hand away. If it checks all the way around to the player in last position and that player makes a weak little stab at the pot, you can check raise. So you can get a lot of information by checking and seeing what all your opponents do. You can sort of improve your relative position and you avoid giving away information about your hand. Like there's only so many hands that you can profitably bet into 3 people. So trying to have a leading a range for donking out here, you basically have to have either a strong hand or a strong draw. And I mean, that's still kind of a tricky range to play against, but at the same time, you're also, you know, that means that you're reliably subtracting all those hands from your range when you check. And it means that, you know, when you do bet, your opponents at least have some idea of what sort of hand you have, whereas when you check, if you just check your full range, like, no one knows what you have, and you can see what everyone else does before you have to make any decision about how you want to play your hand. And this is certainly a hand that could be played several different ways, depending on what happens behind you.
Yeah, it's on top of all that, as you just said, like, why drop kick the best relative position right out the window? That's, yeah. Okay, so, oh, sorry, you're saying this one. Yes. So what happens?
Our hero bets $40 into the $60 pot. The original raiser folds, and he says that an old Asian lady calls, so presumably she was one of the two preflop callers, and the
one
other
hopes,
player folds.
One hopes,
she just tagged in one of the colors.
By the way, I have seen people call bets without hands. Like, the dealer usually just pushes the chips back, but it's been known to happen. It's usually like a calling station who he's just getting back from the bathroom or something, and three people before him call, and he puts his $5 in the pot, and he gets reminded he doesn't have hands. So, you know, some people really like to call, but in this case, I think the
probably one of the preflop callers
seems right. Yeah.
So our hero bets 40. Preflop raiser folds. One of the callers calls. Other caller folds. And our correspondent says that this player is known to chase draws, so I put her on a flush draw or a straight draw. And I've already chastised him for this via email. But you want to avoid narrowing your opponent's range down too far. And you and I kind of already went through the exercise of enumerating the different types of hands that would call on the flop. You certainly want to include flush draws or straight draws in her range, but you don't want to forget about the possibility that there's a lot of pair hands that she's probably going to call you with as well. So that is a pitfall you want to be careful of, which is just zeroing in immediately and assuming this is a player who likes to chase draws, therefore she has a draw. It just means she has draws in her range. Like, players who like to chase draws probably also like to chase pairs or consider them pair draws or whatever.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of the availability heuristic. The old, bank teller, feminist bank teller example.
Right.
Yeah. Don't do that. I think people do this with Vanessa all the time, by the way. It's like, oh, she called. She probably has five high. she does just call with top pair sometimes. You know, that she does play aces. That's a thing that she does. All right. So, and the turn is what?
The deuce of spades. So that is completing a possible flush. The board now, 10 of spades, 7 of spades, 4 of diamonds, deuce of spades, our hero holding 6-5 of clubs. And a correspondent says, I decided to represent the flush myself and bet 80 into 140. I do think having gotten to this point in the hand, firing again to represent the flush is a good idea. Presumably you're also going to be fast playing some, if you're betting here with 6-5, I assume that you're also betting here with some spade draws. So on the turn, that's going to be a very good card for your range in general. If your range for donking the flop is flush draws, straight draws, and strong made hands, like two pairs or sets, then when this card comes on the turn, you now have a bunch of really strong hands in your range and only a little bit of air, or maybe not a small amount, but the only air you have are your straight draws. So given that this is a card that is so good for some portion of your range, you should probably be bluffing it with some other portion of your range. It would be a little bit better if you had a spade in your hand. So if you have a hand like 10-8 offsuit with a spade or 6-5 with one spade, I would call preflop a 6-5 offsuit here, I think. Having a spade in your hand is a little bit better than not. If we really wanted to get into the nitty gritty of choosing specific straight draws that we want to represent the flush with, but I think that the general thinking of saying, I have flush draws in my range, therefore I should try to represent a flush, I think that thinking is correct here.
Yep, I think that's right. I think if I really thought that the person had a draw, either because it was a really sort of exotic player type, like exotic playing player type, or because of some physical tell, then on the turn when I block straight draws and I block no flush draws, I might not want to throw a lot of money at the at that player. But I do think, sort of charitably reading the email, where the person really is aware that there are other hands than draws in the range, then yeah, if I have one draw and the other draw hits and I have six high, that's the time I'm going to be tempted to bet.
He also asked about the sizing. He bet 80 into 140. I think that's I think you can probably go larger. I mean, generally, the thing that should influence your sizing, if you're not being exploitive, in other words, if you don't know that your opponent is going to read, you know, a large bet is weak or vice versa, if you're just kind of trying to find a somewhat balanced, remotely optimal sizing, you kind of have to think about how many bluffs do you have available to you. The more bluffs you have available to you, the larger you can bet with a range that includes value hands and bluffs. So here I think that although you do have a lot of value hands, a lot of hands that have improved to flushes, you also still have a lot of bluffs available. You have all these straight draws. If you're also betting on the flop with some gut shots or like a gut shot plus a spade, some stuff like that. I think you could have a fair number of bluffs available to you on the turn. Your opponent probably does have some hands in her range that are going to have some equity, and you'd like to set up to make a large river bet as well. Like if you're kind of betting with a polarized range, you'd like to give yourself the opportunity to make a large river bet. If she calls, there's going to be a lot of, I wouldn't try to do it on a paired turn, but or a paired river, but I think there'll be a lot of decent rivers for you to throw another barrel out there as well. So I think that airing and betting on the larger side is probably a good idea. I think that's also generally correct when you're trying to get your opponent to fold a pair. I mean, I think that smaller bets, from an exploitive standpoint, smaller bets work best when you're trying to get your opponents to fold hands that just didn't connect with the board at all. So like continuation bets don't necessarily have to be very large, because mostly you're just trying to get your opponent to fold when they miss the flop. When you're actually trying to make your opponent fold a pair, including possibly pairs as good as top pair by the river, if not on the turn, then probably a good idea to use larger sizing or to err on the large side.
I like it. What's the river?
So let's give the turn action first.
Oh,
The opponent called, and our correspondent says, I gave her credit for a small flush. Again, I think this is a little bit too narrow of a read. I can imagine at least some non-flush hands that might call. She may still have something like a straight draw with a spade that she wants to keep calling with. Remember, we do have the read that this is a player who likes to chase draws, so even if you think that's kind of a questionable call, sounds like one that she might make. There could be pair plus flush draw, could be a pair. Maybe she slow played like a set or two pair on the flop and now, you know, doesn't want to raise with it. I would think those hands probably raise the flop, so I'm a little less likely to give her credit for that, but she could have turned two pair. You know, maybe she called you with four deuce and now she turned two pair. I get what you're saying. I do think flush draws are a decent chunk of her range. Just if, you know, she's a player who likes to chase draws, she probably has a fair number of them in her preflop range, and obviously she's not folding them, any of them, on the flop, but there is other stuff in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, imagine that she has Jack 10 with the Jack of Spades or Queen 10 with the Queen of Spades. Like, is she folding before the flop? No. Is she folding on the flop? No. Is she folding on the turn? No. Like, probably not. I mean, some people will, but no. There are a lot of hands to have, so I think.
And, you know, some flushes might raise the turn. I mean, maybe that's why he's saying small flush, that he's thinking that a larger flush would raise. But some people do the opposite. They feel comfortable slow playing the nut flush, but smaller flushes, they think they're vulnerable. They're worried you have a flush draw and they want to raise them. It's possible she has a large flush as well.
Yeah, or would have raised a small flush draw on the flop or a long, yeah. So.
The river is a brick, and our correspondent says, I gave up. His opponent checks behind and turns over ace of spades, seven of hearts for a pair plus a turned nut flush draw. And he now is wondering, I'm really not sure if I could have shaken her on the river because she plays poorly, but it seems like a big bet would have made most people fold, perhaps even fold a small flush. Did I miss a spot? It is hard for me to tell sometimes if I give up too easily. I think the better the player, the more likely I should bluff in this spot. If I do bluff, should I shove or make the quote obvious value bet? First off, I want to dispute the premise that this would be a bad idea for her to call with ace of spades, seven of hearts. Holding the ace of spades is a pretty significant blocker to your range. Arguably, calling with this hand could even be better than calling with some small flushes. Not that I necessarily expect her to think in those terms, but I don't know that for her to call on the river with ace seven is such a bad idea.
No, I don't think so. I was going to say maybe it's better than calling with jacks, but I think this is definitely better than calling with jacks. So, I'm not sure it's better than calling with a small flush, but I think ace of spades, seven of hearts should think about calling. I think it will fold a lot. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a small flush is folding, by the way, right, on the river.
Yeah. Concur.
Sorry. I think a lot of hands are, you know, I think jacks or whatever are calling. I think a lot of really good tens are calling also. I think a bet here is getting called pretty often. People don't like to fold. Yeah, it's tough. It's really player dependent. Yeah, I think this is something I still don't understand very well, or at least as well as I would like to, just when people are going to fold top pair. Like, I think she's got a pretty good top pair hand here, or some kind of good pair pretty often. And I don't really have a good sense of whether your average opponent is going to fold that. Some will, some won't. I have good strategies about what to do against specific opponents I know or people I met half an hour ago. But like in general advice, I would like to be better at this spot than I am. So why don't you say something smart?
All I'm going to say really is that I certainly don't know what a random opponent is going to do when they have top pair here. And so, I think this is one of those spots where you try to play in a way that you are relatively indifferent to what they do with top pair. You bet with all of your hands that, maybe not every hand that can beat top pair, but certainly you bet here for value with all of your flushes. So, if you kind of think about this, like, it sounds like our correspondent is saying, well, if she's gonna fold a small flush to a bet, presumably then you can't really value bet your small flushes, which doesn't make sense to me. So I think that I would bet here on the river with any flush, and probably not anything weaker than that. So I don't think I'd bet it like a set. I wouldn't have bet a set on the turn either, I don't think. But if for some reason, if somehow I had a set on the river, I don't think I would try to bet it for value. But I think I would bet all my flushes for value, and then I would try to balance that by betting some bluffs. Those bluffing, I suppose I have two hands. They're two like candidates for bluffing, which would be either busted straight draws or some sort of small pair, which at this point has little to no showdown value. I think that small pairs may not actually have zero showdown value, because we were talking about the possibility of being called by Jack nine with a spade or something like that, some kind of hand that had a two types of draws, and if she's not going to bluff with those on the river, then you do have a little bit of showdown value. So I think you're probably better off using your busted straight draws to bluff with rather than your small pairs. Even then, I think you're going to end up probably bluffing too much if you bet all of your busted straight draws, and this might not be one of the better ones to bet with because it doesn't contain a spade. So I don't think it's a spot where you need to bluff real often. You should bluff a little bit, and I would probably break that tie based on whether or not I held a spade in my hand.
Excuse me. That makes a lot of sense. I like what you're saying.
So thank you in advance, anonymous student, for forgiving me for using your hand on the air without getting your explicit permission. But your name was not used, and I guess there's a chance if this woman listens to the show, she not only knows that what you had in this hand, but also that you called her an old Asian lady.
Yeah, and if you're the villain in this hand, please write in. I would love to hear from you. Yes. All right, anything else we should tell our listeners?
If they have hands that they would like to hear on the podcast, they can send them to us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. If they have other questions they'd like us to discuss on the show, if they have feedback about the show, if they want to offer to buy one of us dinner or a beer the next time they see us, all of those things are welcome at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And Coaching Carlos is worth picking up. You can get that along with the books that I mentioned earlier on the show at knitcast.com. So if you enjoyed our analysis of this live cash game hand, you can hear us talk with the always delightful Carlos Welch for 4 to 5 hours about cash game strategy. You can pick up those podcasts for $19.99 at www.knitcast.com. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we should be able to bring you a proper show with a proper guest next week. Devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us in?
you want.